Thanks for tuning in for another edition of On Science, the weekly roundup of science stories from NPR. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer with the Science Desk. It was all animals, all the time this week. We'll bring you stories about how cats drink, a cool finding about chimpanzee immunity, and the story of an entire Nevada town coming together to save a toad, even down to the licensed brothel nearby.
This brothel is toad-friendly, right down to the clothing-optional swimming pool out back.
We'll go in right here.
Arulaga says lots of toads hang out here after dark.
We don't bother them or anything like that there. The pool is not chemically treated, so they go in the pool, and their eggs wash down the creek here, and then they hatch along the creek.
But we'll start this week with a story about rocks. This story takes 13.5 billion years to tell, but our science correspondent Robert Krolwich has cut it down a bit. So here's Robert with what he calls a history of rocks. But don't be fooled. It's much more than that.
Bob, you there?
I'm here, yeah.
Okay, so what Robert Hazen, a scientist at the Carnegie Institute, and I are going to do is we're going to talk about rocks. Because when Hazen and his colleagues went back and recounted the history of all the rocks and all the minerals that have ever appeared in the universe since it began, in order, and rocks, by the way, come from minerals, they bumped into a rather unusual surprise.
Yeah.
So let's start counting. If you go back to the Big Bang, the universe begins with a super hot burst of energy, and then gradually that energy cools into hydrogen atoms and helium atoms, and you get vast clouds of gas floating through empty space. And then?
Gravity takes over, and gravity is the great engine of designing and building new minerals.
Gravity pulls things together. So gas gets crunched into tight little balls. They turn bright. They become stars. And those stars, a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, they produce the earliest minerals.
When we look, there are about a dozen different minerals that occur, and diamond is the first.
Diamonds. Why diamonds?
Because when big stars explode.
And stars do explode. And the heat from those explosions, like a furnace, forges new atoms, like carbon. And carbon, of course, includes
microscopic fragments of diamond. And I like to think if you were just in the right place in the right time, you might see this little sparkle or glitter in the sky from all those diamond
fragments. So this is the Paul McCartney, John Lennon universe. This is
there
Lucy in the sky.
Yes, that's the beginning. That's probably 13-plus billion years ago.
Okay, but the big surprise, it's still ahead of us, because all this while, gravity's been creating asteroids, and the squeeze of all that dust crunched together with the occasional asteroid collision.
Splat! And you form a new suite of high-pressure, what are called shock minerals.
So now we've gone from atoms to stars to starbursts to diamonds to shocks till... What's our mineral count now at this point?
Well, now we're up to 250. Whoa. We got up to 250. It's
but
amazing.
But we're not done, because now the rocks clump into bigger spheres and we get a planet.
A planet.
Yes.
Okay, now you got to tell me which kind of planet.
Well, how about a planet with a volcano so things melt and then cool? And...
Ah, the...
Yeah.
I love volcanoes. That's great, because if you especially have a volcano that goes, that means you've got a lot of volatiles.
And what's a volatile?
Water.
Oh.
And the water makes atmosphere, and then it rains, and then the rain cools the surface, and then you get puddles, and you get ponds, and you get oceans, and lakes, and rivers. And that's what dissolves the rocks and gives you salt.
Salt contains water, and clay contains water. There's a whole class of minerals, they call them hydrates, made from water.
And this gets you up to 500 really quickly.
And then the water, and we're talking about water here on Earth, seeps down deep into cracks and crevices.
For billions and billions of years, pulling out the copper, pulling out the zinc, and all these different combinations create little tiny grains of new minerals.
Emeralds, for example, form when water carries off beryllium. Topaz forms when water carries off fluorine. Water adds, subtracts, and creates minerals
that never existed before.
So, the mineral count now from exploding stars and suns and collisions and volcanoes and plate tectonics is about what?
1,500. You can get to 1,500. So 1,500.
That means we start at 12. We're now up to 1,500. I guess we're done.
Unless... There is more.
Really? What else could create a new rock?
Life.
Life. How does life affect rocks?
Because life does things to its surroundings that are amazing.
For example, we had an early form of life on Earth.
Slime.
It must be a more respectable name.
They're called cyanobacteria, but it's really just green slime. It's the scum that you find on ponds. It's the stuff that produces most of the oxygen on Earth today, and it's amazing what it's done.
Because when you have more oxygen, first of all, you get more rust, and you get more minerals with oxygen in them, like a turquoise. You get more oxygen breathers, shellfish, coral. They die, and then they become sedimentary rocks like limestone.
Those minerals can only occur if life arises first.
After all, when you look at the White Cliffs of Dover, what you're looking at is mostly dead plankton, and then the plants stick their roots into the rocks.
And they break them down. The things they break them down into are also weird and new.
Okay, now comes the surprise. Before there was life, we counted 1,500 minerals in the universe. Once life begins, nearly 4 billion years ago, that number jumps all the way to
about 4,500 minerals.
4,500. The number just tripled, which means, I guess, that when rocks meet life, rocks multiply.
Absolutely.
That's so weird. Because, I mean, I've always thought, you know, in the game 20 questions where you say animal, vegetable, or mineral, they're separate categories.
You'd think so. We'd think these were separate.
Yeah, but you're now saying that life can affect non-life.
It's profound because every atom in our bodies came from Earth. Every breath we breathe, every bite of food we take, we are cycling atoms that have been back and forth between life and rocks and life and rocks 1,000 times.
When you eat a raisin, you're getting, you know the expression, vitamins and minerals. So you're putting iron in your blood. When you drink a glass of milk, you're putting calcium in your bones. When you're alive, you need minerals. And when you die,
every atom in our body is going to go back to the rocks. You know, ashes to ashes and dust to dust. We will become part of the rock cycle again. And then the atoms that are in the rocks today will become part of our children and our grandchildren.
So we are changed by minerals. But the surprise here is that minerals are changed by us.
This is it. It's the co-evolution of life and rocks. Rocks make life. Life makes rocks.
And the more life there is, the more rocks there are. Who knew? Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Even if you don't own a cat, you've probably seen one lap up a bowl of milk. Exactly how our feline friends go about doing it has been a scientific mystery until this week. The journal Science has published the conclusive study about how cats drink, and reporter Jeff Brumfield braved his allergies to take a closer look.
It's not every day you get a chance to reproduce a new scientific result, but this one seemed easy enough. All I needed was my neighbor's cat, Bella.
Hello, Bella. Hello. Come here.
I emphasize it seemed easy.
Come on. Oh, you know you want it.
You don't induce the cat to drink. You just wait until the cat decides to drink.
Roman Stacker is a researcher at MIT. He and his colleagues spend hours filming, or trying to film, cats lapping.
The nice thing about it is that the cat laps at an impressive frequency of about 4 times per second. So if you catch only a few seconds of lapping, you have many laps.
Watching in slow motion reveals that cats of all sizes, from tabbies to tigers, have a very elaborate way of drinking. First, they flick their tongue onto the surface of the water and pull it back so quickly that a little jet of liquid flies into the air. Then, in a flash, they catch the jet in their mouth. What's more, when researchers crunched the numbers, they found that cats had it down. Co-author Pedro Reyes.
They really know how to time it perfectly, almost as if they're doing all the equations in their head.
The whole system is much more elaborate than dogs, which simply scoop up water with their tongues. David Hu is a researcher at Georgia Tech.
I have no idea why cats just don't do it the ordinary way. But, you know, that's the weird, interesting thing about biology. What nature does is not necessarily the best way to do things. I think the dogs generally have a better way to do it.
Full disclosure, he owns a poodle. He also recently completed an exhaustive study of how dogs shake themselves dry. All this pet physics might seem a little silly, but it has a point. A lot of researchers are interested in studying the movements of fluids, but modeling drops on a computer can be hard to do. David Hu.
These animals are around, and they have evolved these great ways to deal with very small quantities of water, how to deal with very small amounts of droplets. It's a very hard problem, and we're just looking for inspiration wherever we can get it.
Hu thinks the study of cat lapping could lead to new ways of handling fluids. For his part, Stocker thinks that cat tongues might guide the design of ultra-flexible robots. And as for my own experiment, I did eventually get my neighbor's cat drinking, but Bella's tongue was too fast for me to see. So if you're trying this at home, you'll need a high-speed camera. For NPR News, I'm Jeff Brumfield.
Good girl, Bella. Well done.
The small town of Beatty, Nevada, sits on the eastern edge of Death Valley, between Jackass Flats and Sober Up Gulch. Really. Against all odds, Beatty has become the scene of a small environmental miracle. People here have revived a species that seemed headed for extinction just a few years ago, the Amargosa toad. But this is not your typical story of environmental action. NPR's John Hamilton reports that the toad owes its comeback to an unlikely coalition that includes ranchers, miners, off-road racers, opponents of big government, and the local brothel.
Amargosa toads are warty, speckled creatures about the size of your palm. They come out at night, so that's when you count them.
All right, so let's see. Do we have enough hails?
The Nevada Department of Wildlife organizes toad counts near Beatty twice a year. Tonight, several volunteers carrying buckets and flashlights are shuffling through a cattle pasture. Brian Hobbs is the scientist in charge.
Oh, there's one right there.
Toad or rat?
Another toad.
On Toad City over here.
Yeah.
The toads live anywhere there is water. And even though we're in the desert, there's quite a bit of water, thanks to natural hot springs and a fitful creek known as the Amargosa River. The volunteers place an electronic tag under the skin of any toad that doesn't already have one. It's quiet work. Female toads are silent. So are the males, unless they're being mounted by another male or squeezed by a scientist.
Oh, there's his call.
Yep, that's his release call.
Wow. Gross.
The peonia?
Yeah, a lot.
Yep.
After more than an hour, the team has found only 9 toads. So they head down to the house of a rancher named David Spicer.
Dave?
Good, how are you doing?
Spicer tells them his yard is packed with toads.
When we go over by this light, we're going to really all need every one of us. There's like 50, 60 will be over there.
All right.
Enormous amount of them. We're like toad farmers around here.
Spicer's right. We've hit the toad mother load. Pretty soon, the buckets are full.
What you're seeing tonight with all these animals is we're walking on here picking them up. That's a result of management, active land management, you know, active habitat management.
Spicer says he's run miles of underground pipe around his property to create breeding pools and habitat for the toads. But here's the thing. He's doing all this in part because he really, really does not like the Endangered Species Act.
Nobody trusts the government anymore. Nobody wants to work with the government. The government always wants to take something from you, and they don't look at this as any different, you know?
So more than a decade ago, when some scientists said the toads needed federal protection because there were only a few dozen left, Spicer decided he needed to do something.
Of course, you need to defend yourself against such actions like that because that's not a good thing to have happen, you know?
Spicer feared the government would tell him he couldn't raise cattle or ride off-road vehicles on his own property. So he helped start a group called Storm OV. It stands for Saving Toads Through Off-Road Racing, Ranching, and Mining in Oasis Valley. Storm OV has worked with the government, with groups like the Nature Conservancy, and with locals who just want to save the toad.
We want to keep that in our hands where it's at a local level, where we can do things and be nimble. You know, you get started to get restricted by bureaucracy and monstrous, litigious things that go on in the Endangered Species Act, and we're definitely not going to have any fun on our own ranches anymore.
The group has persuaded landowners to make their properties toad-friendly, and they've worked to get rid of invasive species that threaten the toad, like bullfrogs and crawdads, or plants like tamarisk and cattail that clog the springs where toads live. Other people in Beatty see toad preservation as a way to revive their town.
That used to be the casino over there, and oh, it was a fun place. Before our town died.
Kay Tarr is a retired school teacher who sits on the Beatty Habitat Committee. To the flock of kids who always seem to be scampering through her double wide, she's known as Grandma Kay. Tara likes to give tours of Beatty in her golf cart. A spinal tumor left her unable to work the brake and accelerator pedals with her feet, so she uses the tip of a cane.
We used to have street dances out here in the parking lot, bands up on the trucks, everybody dancing in the street. They even made me get out there and dance in my wheelchair.
When the Bullfrog Gold Mine was still operating a few miles away, more than 2,000 people lived here. Now there might be half that many. But Tar thinks the Amargosa toad could revive Beatty.
See those benches and the trash cans? We'd like to put those all along the riverbed. And this right here is where we would like to start our trail.
The Habitat Committee wants to create a nature trail along the stretch of Amargosa River that runs through town.
And here's a little gully here that we'll have to build a bridge across or something. See, we've got a lot of work to do here.
Yep.
Gosh, there's a tamarisk there. Look at the trash. Oh, my gosh. Oh.
The idea is that this toad habitat will encourage visitors to stay just a little longer and perhaps come back. Shirley Harlan is president of Friends of the Amargosa Toad.
It's been slow, and it's been tedious, and it's been frustrating. But within the past, I'd say 3 years, have we gotten the public educated sufficiently to realize that this is an asset.
For everyone, even folks at Angel's Ladies. It's a licensed brothel run by a couple who used to be in the funeral home business. It even has its own landing strip, complete with the carcass of a twin-engine plane that crashed there more than 30 years ago. Tom Aralaga helps take care of the place.
Here, I'll show you one of the bungalows. We have two of these bungalows, plus every girl has their own room decorated, you know, for customers.
This brothel is toad-friendly, right down to the clothing optional swimming pool out back.
We'll go in right here.
Aralaga says lots of toads hang out here after dark.
We don't bother them or anything like that there. The pool is not chemically treated, so they go in the pool, and their eggs wash down the creek here, and then they hatch along the creek.
And Aralaga says most swimmers seem to like the toads.
There's a few of them up there I've named, big fat ones that come out when I come up here at nighttime and swim, and they'll just come right up to me. And I sit there and I talk to them, and they look at me like I'm their friend. You know, they're kind of cute.
It's a quirky kind of environmentalism, but it's working. This year's toad counts show that their numbers remain in the thousands. And earlier this year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service rejected the latest petition to place the Amargosa toad on the endangered species list. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Researchers at Stanford University in California have come up with a provocative and somewhat astonishing hypothesis. They argue that the same set of genes that explains why chimpanzees are protected from some diseases also explains why humans have big brains. NPR science correspondent Joe Palka has our report.
The story begins with a type of white blood cell we all have in our bodies. They're known as natural killer cells, or NK cells for short.
They can make a big difference as to whether you get sick or whether you don't get sick.
Peter Parham is at Stanford University. He's been studying the genes that control how these NK cells play their role in protecting us from diseases. It's not a simple picture. There are a lot of genes involved. Turns out that chimpanzees also have NK cells, but Parham realized that there must be some key differences between the way our NK cells behave and the way chimp NK cells behave.
There are a number of fairly major infections that affect humans that don't affect chimpanzees. I mean, HIV was one, malaria seems to be another.
Now here's where things take an interesting twist. Not only do natural killer cells play an important role in preventing disease, they also play a role in controlling blood flow between a mother and her developing fetus. That may seem odd, but scientists say it's true. And as pregnancy goes along, blood flow gets more critical.
As the baby gets bigger, its demand for blood goes up.
Especially to keep that big brain of ours growing in the womb. And here's the second interesting twist. There seems to be a trade-off. The kind of NK cells that are good for getting lots of blood to the developing fetus are not as good for dealing with infection, and vice versa. As he reports in the journal PLOS Genetics, when Parham looked closely at the kinds of NK cells most common in humans and compared them with the NK cells most common in chimpanzees, he saw something surprising.
The chimpanzee system seems to be much more optimized for dealing with infection.
Whereas the human system seems to be optimized for getting lots of blood to the developing fetus, so our big brains can grow the way they're supposed to. And that may, just may, have something to do with why we consider ourselves smarter than chimps. Mary Carrington also studies the genes that control NK cells. She's at the National Cancer Institute. She says it's not so surprising that chimpanzees need a more powerful immune system for fighting diseases than humans do.
Humans have been cleaning up all the time for a very long time by building shelter, cooking food, and doing other things like that. And that's decreased our exposure to infectious pathogens.
But as for Parham's somewhat astonishing suggestion that there's a trade-off between a potent immune system and a big brain.
I think that's a good one. The big brain's a little bit of a stretch.
Carrington says the conclusion that natural killer cells are optimized in chimpanzees to prevent disease and in humans to encourage the development of big brains is premature.
That statement is trying to compare humans to chimps with chimp data that we don't necessarily have a really good handle on. But I think it's a fair enough statement, certainly provocative.
And probably one other scientist will be taking a close look at. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
And that's all for On Science this week. You can find more stories next week here on the podcast and online at npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince. Have a great week.